You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday morning, April the 30th. After Hurricanes Rita and Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, some people said that those were just the tip of the iceberg, an example of how climate change was affecting weather patterns. And there were predictions that we would be seeing more storms and they'd be stronger. My guest this hour is an environmental journalist, and he says it's not just the Gulf Coast. The whole world could be facing drastic changes. And while we have heard from skeptics on this program saying that the jury is still out on climate change, or is out at least when it comes to what's causing global warming, and what those consequences would be to global warming, our guest this hour says that the effects of global warming are being underestimated, not overestimated. We'll talk with him about his book, and we will welcome your thoughts and questions for him. He is Fred Pierce. The book is With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And please include your first name and your community with your email. Fred Pierce is the former news editor for the New Scientist magazine. He's author of With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
Pleased to
be here. So, why do you say that the scientists that you've talked to anyway fear that the effects of global warming are being underestimated, not overestimated?
Well, this is my judgment from talking to many dozens of climate scientists in the last 2 years while I've been working on this book, and also talking to many of them over the last 20 years, which is the amount of time that I've been working on this topic on and off, if you like, for New Scientist magazine in London. What they're saying is first of all, they're increasingly certain that climate change, the global warming that we've all experienced in one way or another over the last 30 years, are due to man-made emissions of these greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide. But what they're also saying is that as they investigate more and more the likely consequences of this warming, they can see what they talk about as tipping points or positive feedbacks or just ways in which the whole thing might accelerate. For instance, they're worried that as the world warms, natural stores of these gases may start being released. So carbon dioxide, which is, I guess, the gas that people are most concerned about, might start being released by rainforests as they die because it's simply too hot and too dry for them, by soils, by other gases coming out of melting permafrost in Siberia, a whole range of things which they're beginning to explore and suggest that their existing predictions are maybe just too conservative, just too cautious, and that things may happen rather faster and rather more violently than anybody has suggested so far.
Like the Hollywood movie. What was that movie?
The Day After Tomorrow. But I mean, it won't be quite that fast. So it won't necessarily be overnight. And it won't. But I mean, that was a movie version of it, if you like. But you could see that over a few years or a decade or so, we might see really very stark changes. And that's the fear. I mean, the other thing they've been looking at. The history of climate. Now, that's been a rather unexplored area in the past, and there's much that we don't know. But the more they look, they have new ways of investigating these things now, like looking at the chemistry of ice cores in Greenland and just looking at what the air was like back in those days by measuring the air trapped in bubbles in these ice cores. It's fascinating science. But what they're finding is that when climate does change, it does tends to change very, very fast. Entirely, you know, these are natural processes. We're not now talking about man-made change. But in the past, when we've come into ice ages, gone out of ice ages, big changes, they've not happened gradually, which is what I think scientists used to think. not for any reason, they just sort of kind of thought things happened gradually. What they're finding is that huge changes in temperatures happening over a year or a decade. For instance, they've discovered in much of the North Atlantic region, so the east coast of the U.S. and Canada and Western Europe and up into Greenland, whole wide area of the North Atlantic, that average temperatures changed by more than 10 degrees Celsius, so we're talking about 20 degrees Fahrenheit here, in a decade, 11,000 years ago. Huge and really very fast change. And the fear, of course, is that our efforts at man-made climate change might set off some of the processes that managed to do that. And what the scientists are doing now is trying to explore what some of those processes might be. And that's what the book's about. It's trying to, basically talking to the scientists and ask them what they're doing and where this research is all going and why we may need to kind of prepare for much faster change than we previously expected.
So what sorts of things could indeed happen if these predictions are correct?
Very rapid changes in temperature in probably some parts of the world. It wouldn't necessarily happen everywhere, but there are areas that may be quite vulnerable to sudden change, and they could include parts of the U.S. and parts of Europe. We know that in the North Atlantic, there seems to be kind of systems that flip in and flip out. The Gulf Stream is one of these things. The Gulf Stream, which keeps us warm, may switch on and off. I mean, it's currently on, but it could switch off. That would cool things down. But it may go into kind of super phase, which would warm things up more. Also, I think my guess is that, and I think the guess of many of the scientists that I talk to, is that it'll be rainfall changes that matter most to us even, so that you spoke earlier about hurricanes. They're pretty kind of extreme form of rainfall systems. But even regular storms could just become much more frequent or more intense or disappear altogether, causing droughts. Already the U.S. is suffering in about the eighth year of a drought in the American West, and climate scientists are starting to say, well, is this a drought that's going to go away, or has something changed in the system that means it's going to be permanent? And again, they look back into history and they discover that a few centuries ago there were long periods of drought in the West, which lasted not just 4 or 5 years, but a number of decades, a century or more. So they're beginning to realize that, if you like, the climate system kind of flips into different states, so that we may be in the process of flipping into a different state now. And one of those may be a much drier West in the U.S.
Yeah. Anything in terms of the rest of the U.S.? I mean, is the upper Midwest where we are right now, going to be into some sort of ice age or heat waves?
If I was, you'd be more worried about heat and dryness. I think the whole of the Midwest is in danger of drying out. These are not firm predictions, I should say. Nobody's quite sure. The bottom line of what scientists are saying is that the whole system may be rather more unpredictable than they think, but also much more violent in the sense that big changes could happen. But most of them that I would talk to say that the bigger fear in the Midwest is going to be a much drier climate, partly because it'll become there will simply be less rain, but also as it becomes warmer, the soil will dry out much more quickly, so that it'll be much more easy to get into kind of dust bowl conditions, if you like, going back to the 1930s. Those could happen really, really quite easily with relatively small changes in temperature combined with changes in rainfall. Again, not a prediction, but a real fear.
Yeah. And so why don't we hear so much about these fears of this happening much sooner than we expected?
Well, the scientists are, and by nature, cautious beasts. Some of the skeptics accuse them of being alarmist, but really, actually, I find the scientists are really very cautious. They don't want to make predictions of this sort until they can put them in their computer models, can quantify them, can be reasonably certain about them. They like to talk about the things that they're maybe 60%, 90% certain about, rather than the things that are, if you like, the 30 or 40% fears. And some of these are currently in that category. I think probably they will harden up. But they don't want to alarm us. They don't want to be accused of alarming us as well. But if you go and talk to them in their labs, these are the kind of things that they're coming up with. And I think over the next 2 or 3 years, there are going to be many more reports in the scientific journals, but also in the mainstream media, about some of the more alarming predictions of what's coming out of their research.
Yeah. And what is the solution to this? Is it cutting down on greenhouse gas emissions?
It is. It's as simple as that. I mean, scientists have known for 200 years that these greenhouse gases, and in particular carbon dioxide, which is what we get when we burn coal and oil, that these gases do trap heat in their atmosphere. That's not new science. It's been quantified by, as I say, physicists going back 200 years. So the only question is how much warming we get from it. And if we want to stop that warming, we simply have to stop putting these gases into the atmosphere. We know we're putting them in very large quantities. We know they're accumulating. That's been measured directly for 50 years, and it's been, you know, we know pretty surely it's been going on longer than that. So we have to, and once these gases are in the atmosphere, they also stay there a long time. Carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for a century or more once it's there. So if we're going to stop this, or even just, you know, reduce the rate of warming, let alone causing any cooling, we've really got to stop putting these gases into the atmosphere. And that means, I mean, some lifestyle changes, but it also means new technology. It means using biofuels. It means using more efficient, more efficient car engines, more efficient home heating and air conditioning systems, more efficient everything, which, you know, has a saving in fuel as well. And as oil prices go up, I think we're all going to want to do that anyway, reduce the amount of energy that we use in our daily lives. That'll have a knock-on effect on this. And then introducing all the new technologies for generating electricity without burning fossil fuels at all. We need to get much more into wind power and solar power and geothermal power and hydroelectric power, maybe. All these things. There are a lot of technologies out there. It's just a matter of choosing the most appropriate ones for wherever you live.
We're talking with Fred Pierce, former news editor for The New Scientist magazine. He is the author of the new book, With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, much in the book from scientists who believe that the serious consequences of climate change or global warming are being underestimated, not overestimated. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, Ben Marins is with you between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, Ben and his guests will talk about mental illness, a part of healthcare that we don't always like to talk about, but after the recent Virginia Tech shootings, people are talking about mental illness. And more on that after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We're talking about the consequences and the causes of global warming or climate change. Talking with a guest who has written a new book, With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. And we have open lines for your questions for him, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And Fred Pierce, once again, what is it that you mean by tipping points?
It's a kind of buzz phrase. There's a book, as you probably remember, written about tipping points a while ago. Basically means that in a lot of things that we do in the world, you push, you change things, and nothing much changes, and you work and you work and you work, and suddenly you reach a point at which kind of change happens very fast. So, I mean, it's equivalent to pushing something up the hill, and you push and you push and you push, and suddenly you get over the top of the hill, and you start going down the other side, and it just rolls away from you. You've worked really hard to do something, to push something along the land. it takes a long time before anything much happens. It's really hard, and then suddenly it goes very easily. Now, translate that into climate change, and we may push a lot of gases into the atmosphere and have slow warming, and then suddenly we'll get over a tipping point, and the warming will accelerate and become much faster and much more difficult, in fact, impossible to control. So as in the context of climate, one of the fears is that as we warm the planet, we will suddenly start releasing natural stores of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane, which will then accelerate the warming and release more gases and cause more warming and so on. You'll get a runaway effect. And that's what the scientists are talking about when they refer to tipping points.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the scientist in your book who coined the phrase first of global warming and his research on, what is it, the conveyor belt of the ocean currents?
Yes, Wally Brooker, who's a famous man in scientific circles, if you like, and I've met him a few times. He's quite a character. He's at Columbia University. He's looked a lot at the big ocean currents that move around the world, and the critical one for us is the Gulf Stream, which keeps much of North America and parts of Europe much warmer than, if you like, they're entitled to be given the latitude they're at. You know, I live in London, and it's the same latitude as much as Siberia, but we don't get anything like the cold temperatures they get in Siberia, and that's because of the Gulf Stream. And his fear is that this Gulf Stream system seems to flip on and off quite naturally, but the fear is that global warming may cause another change to that. It might flip it off. Now, if that happened as a result of global warming, it would moderate global warming quite a lot in parts of Europe and North America, and many of us would regard that as quite convenient. But you do a little more research, and you discover that it would also switch off the Asian monsoon. Now, 2 billion people rely on the Asian monsoon rains in order to grow their crops every year. So that would be a major global calamity. But as I say, Wally's a great guy, and he's been working on this a long time. One of the things he says, one of my favorite quotes from him, is he says, look, the climate system, the whole way that the climate on the atmosphere works, it's like a wild dog. And he says, we, through our actions, through burning greenhouse gases and putting these carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we are poking that wild dog with a very sharp stick. And his point is that it's not a good thing to do. And his other point, I guess, is that if we should stop poking, we should calm down a bit, we should stop terrorizing this dog. Maybe it would stop terrorizing us, I guess, is the message that he's got.
Yeah. You do also talk in the book about the global warming skeptics, and talk some more about whether or not there truly is a consensus in the scientific community about these issues.
In my experience, there's more consensus in the scientific community on global warming than there is on almost any other topic that you care to mention, certainly in the environmental field. There's a very wide consensus, but it's not a total consensus. Most of the physics of climate change is accepted even by the most ardent skeptics. Their only question is exactly how far it'll go and whether there might be some things that'll slow it down rather than, as I'm suggesting, that will speed it up. I've got a lot of time for some of the skeptics anyway. Some of them are, if you like, sort of lobbyists and economists who somehow think that they're experts on climate change. But, for the scientists who are involved in it, I've got a good bit of time for them. I think they're right in one particular. I think the mainstream scientists, if you like, the consensus view, those scientists can get a bit over-persuaded by their computer models and their calculations that they really do know exactly how climate change is going to pan out. And I think when the skeptics criticize them for that, they're quite right. Where I think the skeptics go wrong is in assuming that because maybe the future is a little more uncertain than the mainstream scientists think, that therefore we're going to have less trouble with global warming, that it'll be less of an issue. I think, you know, error bars go both sides, and I think the big risk, I think there is at least as great a risk that global warming will be far more serious than the mainstream modelers currently suggest. And I know a lot of scientists who agree with me and whose recent research, and it is the recent research which I've been putting into the book, are taking that view. So I think over the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to see many more alarming predictions published in the press. A lot of the things that are in my book are things which are not yet published in the, if you like, the official scientific literature. But they are going to come out, and they're going to change the nature of the debate, and it won't be in the direction of the climate skeptics, who seem to be losing the argument in many areas. Much as I like them as people, and I like their kind of heretical approach. That's, you know, my kind of science in a way. But I do actually think they're wrong. I do think that the uncertainty is going to start panning out in the other direction, and that we're going to be more fearful of more dramatic and faster climate change rather than kind of being reassured. Mm-hmm. That's the way I see the science going in the next 5 years.
Let's start taking some calls. Janica in Dousman is with us first. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Hi. I'm enjoying this very much. First of all, I'm a believer in global warming. I'm not one of those skeptics out there. I have a problem a little bit with your approach, which is kind of, sounds to me anyways, alarmist. And I had two comments about, you know, the fear approach. Mm. One is that when people get really afraid of something, like, for example, global warming, and they hear all these very scary predictions, I think it's possible that they just kind of shut down and, you know, oh, I can't do anything about it anyways. It's very overwhelming to me. And then they don't take action. Now, this, to me, could be solved if we had a government in place in Washington that would take the lead on this and help us do something about it. I think that would be where this information should be coming from. But as we all know, it's not. And my second point, and I'll take any comments off the air, is that I live in the Midwest, and when you made the reference to the Dust Bowl, the Midwest could become a Dust Bowl. Again, I'm not an expert. I just finished a book on the Dust Bowl, as a matter of fact, that happened in the West in the 1930s, and they said that two factors were happening to cause this. One is that the land was hundreds of thousands of millions of acres were denuded by man and women plowing up the ground and stripping the ground of its natural grasses and foliage. Then what happened was a number of years of drought. So how are we going to have that kind of dust bowl in the Midwest if we're not stripping the land of all the things that hold it down, you know, hold down the earth?
Well, I mean, on the Dust Bowl, I certainly agree that soil conservation is a major issue. It will certainly, it's good for very many reasons, but one of the reasons it is very good is that it will help to, if you like, buffer soils and wider ecosystems from climate change like droughts. Anything that you can do to make the system more resilient so that when climate change does come, and in one form or another it is going to come, then that's a good thing. If the soils are in good heart, then they will be much more able to resist a long period of drought. But if a drought goes on and on and on, I would guess that almost any soil will eventually be in trouble. So there are a lot of things that we could do, and I certainly don't want to give the impression that there's nothing we can do. I am criticized. I've been criticized by a number of people for, if you like, being as you say, for being alarmist. I'm not trying to be alarmist, but I'm trying to point out the scale of the things that we're dealing with here. This is not, if you like, a regular kind of environmental problem. It is we are interfering with some very basic processes that keep our planet habitable, if you want to put it that way. Things like the carbon cycle and the way the carbon moves around the planet is basically the planet's thermostat, and we're fiddling with that thermostat. So these are very dangerous waters, but I don't want to give the impression there's nothing we can do. There's a very great deal we can do. I'm an optimist in that regard. While I do believe that there are nasty tipping points in the natural system, if you like, the way the climate system could run out of control, I'm also a firm believer that there are tipping points in, if you like, our political system, our economic system, our cultural system, which means that we can deal with this. We just have to get it together to do it. I don't think there are not great technical problems here. There are a lot of technologies that could reduce the amount of emissions that we produce very drastically, 70 or 80%, quite reasonably, without having to make huge change to our lifestyles. I think air travel is a big issue, but in most other respects, we could reduce our emissions without if we applied the technology. Much of that technology is now is economically perfectly reasonable. It doesn't have a big economic penalty. Certainly, with gasoline, with oil coming out of the ground at $60 a barrel, many of these technologies are perfectly competitive with that. I think the issue is political, and I think you touched on that. It's a matter of not just what happens in Washington, but a wider political debate of how we actually make these things happen. I begin to think that the corporations are now ahead of governments in many parts of the world, and not least in the U.S. I see corporations asking governments to act on this, because many corporations see that there is money to be made out of the new clean technologies. And the good corporations, the big corporations, the one with the good with the big R&D departments, want to get into this because they think they can get a head start and they can make money out of it. So there is potential here, I think, to get over a tipping point there where suddenly corporations are not hostile to discussion of climate change and doing something about it. They're actively embracing it, and I begin to see that. So, as I say, I think there are nasty tipping points in the natural system. There are good tipping points potentially in the political and economic and the corporate system if we can only get there. We have to work hard to do it, but we can. Once we get over those tipping points, we might, I only say might, in 50 years' time look back and think, why the hell do we make so much fuss about it? We fixed the problem. We can fix the problem.
Well, thanks to Janica. Paul in La Crosse is next. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yes, you came around to my point. I think there's just way too much talk in the community now about scientists this and scientists that. Everybody is tired of hearing about scientists. Mm. It sounds like it's a bunch of guys in lab coats sitting around and drinking coffee and talking hypothetically about stuff.
Yeah, they do. They do all that. I tell you.
but you see, now this last part that you mentioned was my point. Mm. You must, if you want to make this real, you have to talk about the business community, because the business community is going to do what the market wants. And right now, the thing that I have been following for the last 5 years is the new shipping lanes that will be opening up between China and Europe using the Northwest Passage. And people think that we're talking about something that was a pipe dream like 200 years ago that just didn't work, and thousands of, many, many ships went down trying to find it. But it does exist, and there are businesses, corporations, major corporations up there developing port facilities to take care of these vessels when they start making this trip that'll save over 50% of the mileage between China and Europe. And it's these concrete things about how business is reacting to climate change that people can get their hands around and saying, okay, now it really exists. They don't care about the hypotheticals of soil blowing away or anything like this, because they've seen that for the last 100 years. There has to be something that gets through to people, and I think that the way they can do that is by looking at the way business is dealing with this situation.
Okay, that's a fair point. I mean, I'm a science journalist, so I'm going to stand up for, what the scientists do. I think it's important, but you're right. They are only informing a debate. They are helping us. I mean, if the business people had read about the science stuff saying that the Arctic is likely to become largely ice-free, certainly in summer, and the Northwest Passage will start opening up, they wouldn't be thinking about these things. They need the science to inform them so that they can make good decisions. That's true when you're talking about climate change as if you're working in a lab on a new piece of equipment. So science has an important role, but science is only useful for society if it informs us, if it helps us make decisions, whether it's about our greenhouse gas emissions or where you build your port facilities. Science is only a tool, and if science ceases to be a useful tool, then the public will pull the plug on it.
Our guest is Fred Pierce. He is author of With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change, in which he discusses that the consequences of global warming or climate change may be underestimated, not overestimated, talking about how we could be facing mega droughts and super hurricanes and other catastrophic climatic changes. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, unless we cut back on those greenhouse gas emissions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guests will review the top political stories of the past week after 9 o'clock. And then after 10 o'clock, Kathleen and her guest will discuss the wage gap between college-educated women and men, according to a recent report. That's coming up. Kathleen Dunn with you between 9 and 11. We're talking about climate change with a guest who is an environmental journalist. He has been the news editor for the New Scientist magazine, and over the last couple of decades, he has been researching and reporting and writing about climate change, and he says that the more he learns, the worse things look. And in his new book, he talks about how many scientists believe that if greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise at the current rate, the planet will experience catastrophic change in less than 10 years. His book is With Speed and Violence, Why Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Change. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Jack in Madison is our next caller. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I think as time goes on, it becomes clear that we're, the whole way we're operating our economy and our business cycle is completely leading us into catastrophe. And I think that our reliance on the corporations is really a mistake. We have a very serious overpopulation problem, and we have overconsumption. And your guest hasn't mentioned either of these issues as relevant to the discussion.
Right. Yeah, I think overconsumption in particular, yes, I am worried about it. I think the overpopulation problem, the population growth in the world by and large today is among the people who consume the least. So there's a potential there. But right now the issue is if you like, the consumption patterns of the richer parts of the world. I think we have to address that. But I mean, there are things that we can do. There are technical fixes. We can use our energy much more efficiently. We can generate our energy in much more efficient ways and much less carbon-intensive ways, if I can put it that way. In other words, not burning coal and oil on anything like the scale that we currently do. There are a lot of things that we can do which will allow us to maintain large parts of our lifestyle without dramatic changes. There's detailed work being done on this that suggests in much of our lives we could reduce our emissions by 60, 70, 80% by really relatively modest reorganizations of the way that we individuals and that we as a society work. The big problem I find, or the big area where I don't think we can do that, is in air travel. Air travel is becoming a major source of greenhouse gas emissions. It's not the biggest source, but it is a major source, and every flight that you take has quite a strong effect. If I come across the Atlantic in order to do some presentations here in the U.S., I know that the single return flight across the Atlantic has been responsible for as much emissions as driving a car around the U.K. for a whole year. Mm. So that is an area where I think overconsumption is going to become a big issue because there simply are no technical fixes currently for our emissions from aircraft. So there are fixes, but I think actually talking about tipping points in the economic and political system, I also think there are tipping points in the cultural system. There'll be certain kinds of things that will begin to become unacceptable to do. In the way that people have suddenly got turned onto hybrid cars, there are going to be more and more of these things where people think, well, you know, I'm a responsible citizen. I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to use the new energy efficient light bulbs. I'm not going to take flights unnecessarily. I'm going to have a hybrid car, or I'm going to burn, you know, have biofuels in my car, or whatever it may be. A whole series of things. I'm going to insulate my house better so that it doesn't use so much energy. I'm going to turn off the air conditioning whenever I can. mixture, these kind of cultural things, which are no real big deal for us. I mean, a few years ago, nobody would have thought about recycling, whereas most these days in many, many cities, recycling is just absolutely routine. So we can change the way we live. It doesn't really alter our lifestyle in any substantial way, but we can have big effects. So I think overconsumption and the way we consume is a big issue, but that doesn't mean that we have to really have a sort of hair shirt society in order to solve this problem.
Fred Pierce, we have had listeners suggest that on this program I interview someone involved in the production of a BBC documentary called The Great Global Warming Swindle. Are you familiar with that?
It certainly wasn't the BBC, and they'd be very cross if you said it was.
Oh, really? What is it?
It was put out on Channel 4 in the UK. The BBC had pretty much nothing to do with it. That was a very strange program. It basically argued that the world's climate scientists were engaged, and I'm not exaggerating, this really is what it said, mm-hmm. the world's climate scientists were engaged in a giant conspiracy to persuade us that there was a climate change problem when there wasn't, and that they were making up their data and that they were abusing their data and so on.
Yeah, saying
that's pretty wild stuff, and I've seen it. They didn't stand it up. I know some of the climate scientists they spoke to. Some of the scientists interviewed in that program got very angry. They felt that they'd been seriously misrepresented in what they wanted to say and what the program was about. And it was very bad and unprincipled journalism, I think I would put it that way, involving quite a lot of misuse of data on its own account.
Yeah, and the reason I brought that up is that it was conveyed to me, though I haven't seen the actual piece, that this was that it, there was a research economic financial incentive for scientists to claim that global warming was man-made and/or was caused by greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, you can always, I guess, make that argument about scientists that they've, but we all have a job to do. But I mean, science has a rather better system for checking on what people say is true. They have a peer-reviewed system. If you want to get your science into the mainstream science literature, it's got to be checked very rigorously by a lot of other people. Not many other professions are that good at it. But this whole thing about the sort of climate change conspiracy argument is very similar to the argument that we used to hear a decade or so ago, when skeptics in the AIDS debate would say there is an AIDS conspiracy going on, and there is an AIDS industry, and they are trying to persuade us that the HIV virus causes AIDS. Now, quite a lot of people believed that conspiracy theory for a while, but we don't hear much about it now. Mm-hmm. And I think, frankly, this climate change conspiracy theory is going to die in much the same way. Now, I'm not saying that some of the climate skeptics don't have useful things to say, and they certainly should be allowed to say them, and I, as a journalist, report them. But this whole conspiracy notion, I think, is very silly.
Yeah. Susan in Coon Valley is with us next. Hello, Susan, you're on the air. Susan, are you there? I don't know where Susan is. So we will go on to Richard in New Berlin. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Yes, I've kind of stepped away from this global warming situation quite a bit, like 93 million miles, I think it is, to the sun, thinking that if the sun were to quit throwing off its heat towards the Earth, we'd end up being at close to absolute zero, probably, which is like 400 below zero. Now, it seems to me that if the sun is going through its natural cycles, it would only have to go up a very, very small percent in heat to change the temperature on the Earth a degree or two. So we might be all chasing around trying to do something here, and the sun is doing its natural cycle, which causes ice ages and melts ice ages, and nothing that we do is going to change what the sun is doing.
That's true. And this, of course, ultimately the sun is the source of all the energy, or most of the energy on the Earth, and the warmth that we have. I don't think anybody is saying, or certainly nobody should say, that there aren't natural cycles and that there isn't natural climate change. There undoubtedly is. The Ice Age is a pretty prominent example, and there are others, little ice ages and medieval warm periods and all sorts of things. There are cycles in the climate system. The question is whether we are now intervening on such a scale that we are causing our own climate change, and whether that is dangerous and destructive for us as a society. And I believe that it is. The other thing to say, I guess, is that the most intense warming we've seen... Well, no, let's say two things. First of all, that much of the climate change that we've seen in the last 200 years is probably due to solar cycles, principally. So there was a warmish period in the first part of the 20th century caused by solar changes. There's a coolish period in the middle of the 20th century caused by climate changes, principally the sun. What we can't explain with the sun is what's happened in the last 30, 35 years, when there's been very dramatic warming, faster warming, so far as the scientists say, than they're aware of at any other period in the recent past, in the last few thousand years anyway. And that cannot be due to solar effects, because the solar influence on our climate, if anything, would have been causing a marginal cooling. Not much in it, but if anything, it would have been causing cooling. And yet, we've had warming. Basically, the scientists say that up to 1970, we could explain pretty much all the climate change that they're aware of by solar and other natural influences. But after 1970, we really can't. And after 1970 is the period when there have been the highest greenhouse gas emissions, when we have the records which show that these greenhouse gases, which we know from basic physics do trap heat in the atmosphere, have been accumulating fastest in the atmosphere. So I think it would be very surprising, it would be more or less miraculous, if those gases weren't causing a warming, and it looks like they are. I don't see, I've gone through the skeptic's arguments. I've pursued this in some way, and I'm a kind of scientific heretic in a small way myself. I don't like to accept mainstream arguments unless they really do stand up. But it seems to me that those arguments do stand up, that there is no other explanation for the warming and the other climate changes that we've seen in the last 30 years other than those greenhouse gases. Yes, the sun's important, but it can't explain what's been going on. Excuse me.
Thanks to
in
Richard.
The last couple of years.
Susan in Coon Valley, we hope, is there this time. Hello, Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Just making reference to a couple of previous callers, one mentioned about the Dust Bowl of in the 30s, and another made reference to getting tired of hearing scientists. Well, number one, I respect what scientists are saying. And number two, when you look at the percentage of topsoil that disappears from our land every year, I think it's significant to look at that. And part of that is due to lack of tree planting. Part of that is due to the lack of strip cropping. Part of that is due to things getting bigger, okay, farmers getting bigger. And I don't think we can minimize the fact that the base of our economy has to do, partially with food. And if we get to the point where we cannot raise our own food and we have to rely on imports, we're going to be in big trouble.
I think you're absolutely right. There is a recent book out which is very good on this called Dirt, which looks at soil and civilizations going back through history and shows how absolutely critical maintaining soils are to the survival of civilizations. And many major civilizations have gone down because they didn't look after their soil. And climate poses a whole new set of challenges for how we manage, one of our really basic resources. We do have to look out for this.
Yeah. Now, we have also heard from skeptics who say, you know what, scientists have predicted that last hurricane season was going to mimic the Hurricane Katrina season, and it was going to be more intense and these severe Category 4 storms, and it didn't happen. Scientists can be wrong, and maybe they're wrong about this, too.
I think what's going to happen to hurricanes is one of the less certain aspects of climate change. Partly because the data on the natural variability is really very poor. There are quite a few scientists who do believe that while there haven't been more hurricanes, they're becoming more intense. To some extent, there are, but there are perfectly valid reasons why people might think that hurricanes might not become more intense. The reason why scientists think hurricanes might become more intense is because they're triggered by at a certain temperature of the ocean. Until the oceans reach a certain threshold temperature, hurricanes simply don't form. So if the oceans are warming, which they are, you might expect to get more hurricanes and more intense hurricanes. But there are other things that happen in the atmosphere that might counterbalance that. So it's an area of uncertainty, but it's one of those areas where I think you want to say, well, you know, how lucky do we feel? Do we really want to sort of put all our dice on the assumption that hurricanes won't get worse, or do we want to think, well, kind of hedge our bets a bit? The science in this area may not be too certain, but the risks that we're running, you know, they're quite high. I think. I mean, some scientists and environmentalists say, well, if I can put it this way, a 9/11 in the climate change debate, it probably would be a whole series of major hurricanes up the eastern coast of the U.S. And there is a risk of that. I'm not predicting it. I'm not saying it will happen. And I wouldn't say that if it didn't happen, that would be some kind of refutation of global warming. But it is a risk.
And we go next to Mike in Seneca. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I have two quick ones here I haven't ever heard discussed on this type of show before. Number one, if we acted today, how long would it take to save our planet or simply reverse the situation? Number two, that with the present administration, it appears the trend is to eliminate the nuclear power from third world countries, and on the contrary, it seems like with China, for example, they are full steam ahead on doing what we're doing. Yeah. And what about that?
Yeah, and we only have less than 2 minutes in the program.
How long? I don't think we're ever going to go back to where we were. There is quite a lot of warming already, if you like, in the system. There are time lags in how the climate responds to our emissions. And there is no on-off switch. It's a continuous process. There may be tipping points in it, but there is a continuous process. We can stop the worst. I think that's about as far as it goes. That's about as far as I'd put it. Nuclear power, yeah. I mean, nuclear power has a great potential to solve some of the problems because it is a low-carbon way of generating energy. But as we all know, there are safety issues surrounding it. There are waste disposal issues surrounding it. And there are nuclear proliferation issues surrounding it. And those are perhaps the ones that concern us most now. So there is that's a hard debate for society as a whole to have. Do we really want to go the nuclear route in order to do something about climate change? I think we may well land up doing that, but there are serious issues surrounding that.
Yeah, if China doesn't cut back on greenhouse emissions, does it matter if we do?
Yes, it does. China is still only the second biggest, and China has an entitlement to produce quite a lot of greenhouse gases emissions. It does have the world's largest population. Mm-hmm. Every Chinaman produces only a fifth as much carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions as every American. I don't want the Chinese to reach the American level, but I think we in the already rich world have a duty to start acting first.
Well, sorry,
I think the Chinese will follow. They follow us in most things. I think they'll follow us in that, not least because they'll want to sell us lots of clean energy kit.
And now we really are out of time. Thanks a lot for being with us. Fred Pierce, author of With Speed and Violence. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.